Hello and welcome to the Majlis Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs podcast focusing on Central Asia. I am Mohammed Tahir, the host of the Majlis podcast and Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager here in Washington, D.C. The Russia-led Eurasia Economic Union has experienced another setback last week when the presidents of participating countries couldn't agree on the content of proposed strategic plan for the upcoming 5 years. Most direct and pointed reservation came from the President Tokayev of Kazakhstan, in which he said the plan threatens the sovereignty of the neighboring states. Kyrgyz and Belarusian sides have already been expressing various concerns on issues ranging from trade barriers to some members' privileges, rights, influence on decision-making, etc. On today's Majlis podcast, we are here to discuss what are the sources of these dissenting voices, how these frustrations are expected to develop going forward as the region struggle with the impact and financial fallout of COVID-19. To discuss all these, I'm joined by Askar Sidikov, the Executive Director of the International Business Council of Kyrgyzstan, Ben Goodwin, Head of Analysis at PRISM Political Risk Management, who specializes in Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, Dr. Irina Busigina, professor at the High School of Economics in St. Petersburg, Russia, Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia, blog, Kishlok Owazi. Thank you, colleagues, for joining us today on this important discussion. So, Askar, let me start with you. You met the Kyrgyz president the other day following the leaders' summit of Eurasia Economic Union, where the Kyrgyz president made a number of critical remarks. So what did he tell you? Why he said what he said?
Thank you, Muhammad. It's a pleasure to be a part of Majlis podcast and good to see my colleagues from other countries. As to your point about the Eurasian Economic Union membership and the issues that we faced here in Kyrgyzstan, we didn't really talk about it with president, neither did we discuss it with the government. We've been voicing these issues with the media, mostly during the state of emergency that we had here due to COVID-19.
What issues are they, Askar?
Well, since the beginning of March, we had shortages of some of the supplies used in industry, used for other economy sectors, and also some of the food supplies that we get from Kazakhstan or via Kazakhstan, from Russia, from Belarus, and other countries. For instance, even from Turkey, the trade route from Turkey goes through Kazakhstan. And as our truck carriers informed us, they had long lines between the border of Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, stuck and couldn't get into Kyrgyzstan. But then closer to April, these issues were more or less resolved. The two parties agreed for kind of non-limited movement of goods used for medicals and for food security. And in late April, and now in May, it's more or less sorted out.
Okay. So when President Jeenbekov was talking about the trade barriers in the summit, these were the points he had in mind?
Probably, yes. Okay. Because there have been lots of criticism, not only during this COVID situation, but during the past several years when the trucks have been stuck at our border with Kazakhstan, and our country's leadership has been invoking those Eurasian Economic Union regulations and rules, and the basic freedoms like freedom of movement of goods, services, capital, and human force.
Right. So your issue, your issue is with Kazakhstan.
It's with Kazakhstan mainly because our railroad, northern railroad, going to our capital goes through Kazakhstan, and also the main truck routes go via Kazakhstan.
Okay.
But also during this COVID situation, we had the issue on the border of Kazakhstan and Russia as well, bordering the Orenburg region of Russia. Some of our citizens returning back to their homes here, they were stuck for several days there.
Okay, so Ben, Kazakh president was rather more pointed when he said the proposed strategy threatens the sovereign rights of membering states. At least in my opinion, it's a new level of criticism. He's seriously bothered by something. What's the inside story here?
Yeah, well, I think he had sort of three basic criticisms that were, as you said, quite pointed. The first was, and this relates to something that Asghar just said, that a lot of the stuff that was agreed in the original 2015 agreement has not been implemented. And so countries are still experiencing trade barriers, mostly non-tariff barriers. So getting goods across borders is still difficult because of things like regulatory and sanitary reasons rather than pure sort of customs reasons. But the second thing, as you said, that he referred to the fact that the Eurasian Economic Union should be a group of sovereign nations making decisions together rather than a group of sovereign nations handing over power to a supranational body. And in this case, he referred to the Eurasian Economic Commission, which is the body that coordinates the Eurasian Economic Union. It's sort of similar to the European Union's European Commission. And he referred to a principle that people in the European Union are familiar with, which is subsidiarity, i.e. anything that doesn't require moving up to a higher authority should remain at the national level. And he was sort of very pointed in his criticism of the Eurasian Economic Commission, which he sort of hinted was sort of pushing an agenda forward that was not in the interests of the member states, but was in the interests of the Eurasian Economic Union. Now, in terms of what's taking place here, I would say there's one unsurprising thing about this and one very surprising thing about this. The unsurprising point is that member nations of the Eurasian Economic Union are not happy with the situation as it currently stands. And as we've heard from Asghar, and you know, we regularly read in the media and in terms of government debates, there's a lot of problems with actually getting products and services moving across borders easily. And a lot of that blame is sort of laid at Russia's door, whether that's fair or not is another question. But the thing that is surprising is that Tokayev so openly stated it in a public meeting directly to President Putin's face. Admittedly, it was over a Zoom call, given the coronavirus crisis, but it was expressed very outwardly. I think his predecessor, First President Nursultan Nazarbayev, would not have done that, and it would probably have been kept behind closed doors, although the criticisms would have remained.
That's interesting. So on the trade barrier, though, Ben, Kazakhstan seems to be part of the problem. I mean, when you look into this from Kyrgyzstan.
Yes, I think it's the case. I think, you know, a union like this requires reciprocity. And if countries are not able to find agreement as to which goods are able to move across which borders, they start to make their own decisions and act in their own interests. So it doesn't surprise me that, you know, there are disputes between Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan and between other constituent members of the Eurasian Economic Union.
Okay, let me bring you in, Irina, here. So how did these comments, I mean, the conversation that participating nations had last week during the summit, I mean, these pointed criticism that we are talking about coming from Tokayev and the Kyrgyz president's concerns, how these discussions are reflecting in Russia on the official level?
You know, this is more or less where I can have only informative guess, I would say. Still, I would say that they are to be expected, and they are expected. So I'm talking about my political elite in my country. I don't think that they take it as something coming like a surprise. Since from the very beginning, the Eurasian Economic Union was a subject to critique. The reason, and this is also very obvious reason, lies not only in the huge asymmetries between the member countries, but also in the lack of the credibility of the commitments which Russia makes with regards to the member states, as well as the mismatch of the incentives and priorities which basically caused or led to the creation of the Eurasian Economic Union, because the from the Russian side, and that's why this critique from the membering countries, from their presidents, is expected, because this mismatch, and because very obvious thing that from the Russian side the main incentive was non-economic. You know, it was non-economic for Russian economy. This economic cooperation or integration, though these are very different things, these countries are more a burden than a booty or something like an addition to the Russian economy. You know, so this is economically, it is insignificant. So I think that from the Russian side, this is kind of a clear understanding that if you do something because of mainly geopolitical and non-economic reasons, so this is to be expected. And so this is a very different thing than you start a project and then you maintain the project. You know, the conditions which brought the Eurasian Economic Union to the being were very different from these conditions or circumstances which require the further existence of the Union. I would also like to make one more point, saying that, you know, talking about Eurasian Economic Union, I would say that we need to do a conceptual differentiation between economic cooperation and integration. You know, you can cooperate without any integration. This is not a problem. And then we can talk about these gems, these drugs, as a, I would say, lack of coordination, more or less, you know, in particular also in Orenburg and in the Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, especially under the current very difficult situation with the COVID-19 and the problems they proceed not only in this region of the world, but elsewhere. But this is the economic cooperation. The problem is not that much with cooperation. The problem is with the integration, and that's why, you know, the Eurasian Economic Commission, which is the kind of the embodiment of this supranationality in the Union, this is and will be the subject of the even more severe critique.
So just to follow up on that, so the points that Kazakh president made during this summit, especially his critique about these additional articles which were planned to be added in the upcoming strategy of the organization. So where those points are coming from? Whose initiatives were they, and what was the logic behind adding those points into this strategy in the first place?
You know, this is the problem. You know, again, this is the inbuilt problem into the Russian foreign policy, I would say. You know, since this is not the first or the second or even the third project that Russia would launch in with the post-Soviet countries. And again, here, this is the problem of the dynamic. How you develop it? You know, okay, you need to show that there is a development, there is a dynamic, you know, and here where you very fast come to the limits of the so-called integration project. You know, because this is in the Russian interest to show at least that we are doing something, we are progressing. But to show this progress, to present Eurasian Economic Union to the Russian internal audience, and this is one of the main kind of goals for the Russian leadership, to sell the project to the Russian internal audience. How you can sell this project? You can sell this project with the progress. The problem is that every progress, you know, every strategy, or be it another kind of high-level document, it comes across the another vision, comes, you know, contradicts to the different vision of the, how they are called in Russia, smaller member states of the Eurasian Economic Union.
Bruce, let me bring you in here. Irina is kind of raising some fundamental issues here. Maybe we will get to that a little bit later. But how serious do you see the discussion were taking place last week during the summit? And what does the timing tell you?
Well, I mean, there's always been some grumbling. So, you know, obviously I'm looking at this from the point of view of the two Central Asian members of it. And there's always been some grumbling about this, particularly from Kazakhstan, that rules were changed without consulting with everybody in the organization, and they pinned that on Russia. This was interesting, I thought, from Kazakhstan's point of view. It's much more vocal and open this time. You know, and even Kyrgyzstan, it was kind of interesting that, on the one hand, Jeenbekov, for instance, made some mild criticism of the Eurasian Economic Union, but he also wanted more involvement, you know, to clear up these issues of transit, you know, and trade. You know, he wanted there to be an arbitration court that would oversee problems at the borders and smooth this out. I mean, it was kind of a little of both, but certainly, you know, for both the Kyrgyz and Kazakh leaders to raise issues at a meeting like this was something that was a little bit unusual and showed that there's still some dissatisfaction. I'm not sure if they thought maybe this was the right moment to do that, if they're hard pressed because the virus and everything, and they want to keep their economies going as much as possible. But there was more resistance, I thought, this time than in previous meetings where, you know, like Ben said, a lot of times they kind of paper these things over and they're agreed with in the back room. You know, it's like, let's don't raise this issue right now. We'll get to this. We can get together after this and discuss it and we'll smooth everything out. You know, that said, I thought, I was looking at the Russian media for reports on what was happening, because I'm seeing what they say in Central Asia. Jeenbekov wants arbitration court. You know, Tokayev is worried about losing sovereignty, and he doesn't think that their trade relations with third-party countries outside the EU need oversight from within the EU, the Eurasian Economic Union. But the Russian media was more focused on Armenia and Belarus problems with gas.
Yeah,
you know, they seem to just paper over entirely what the Central Asians were saying, you know, and that just showed me that there still is a disconnect in the way these countries are looking at what the main problems are that they need to resolve.
Given these problems, we are not seeing Uzbekistan and Tajikistan joining this organization anytime soon, I guess.
Well, you know, that's hard to say. I think Tajikistan's in a hard place where eventually they would almost have to. You know, if anything, I think they would. It seems to me now that Russia's kind of pulled back on that lately. It was talk in Dushanbe a couple of years ago that they were getting everything ready to join, and it should have happened last year. And when Kyrgyzstan joined, they said, okay, Tajikistan 2018, 2019, you know, they'll get membership. So, but as far as I can tell, from what I've read, it seems like Russia is the one that's actually holding that up. Uzbekistan, you know, they were resisted too much Russian influence for a long time. They didn't want it under Karimov. And I don't think they're that anxious to jump back in. On the other hand, they want to show that they're ready for better ties with Russia. And so they kind of picked middle ground by saying, okay, we'll be an observer country for now. It suits their purposes. They keep all their doors open to relations with other countries. And at the same time, they've expressed some interest in joining the Eurasian Economic Union and got, you know, this observer status to show that they have a half a foot in the door, we'll say.
Right. Okay, so speaking of the timing, of course, stress born out of COVID-19 is the first thing that comes to mind, though it's merely a new element, as we were talking about, on the list of growing frustration within the membering states. But the difference now is the frustration is growing, getting sharper. On the top of that, you have potential fallout of COVID-19, which the countries in the region yet to fully face. So what the future holds for this organization in Central Asia? Let's continue the discussion talking about these and many other questions very shortly. First, let me recap the debate. That today on the Majlis, I'm joined by Askar Sadikov, the Executive Director of the International Business Council of Kyrgyzstan. Askar is joining us from Bishkek. Ben Goodwin, Head of Analysis at PRISM Political Risk Management. Ben is joining us from UK. Dr. Irina Busigina, Professor at the Higher School of Economics in St. Petersburg, Russia, who is currently a visiting fellow at the Harvard University's Davis Center. Irina is joining us from Boston. Bruce Panier, the Editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia Blog. Kishlok Awazi. Bruce is in Prague. I'm Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager and the host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, colleagues. So, Irina, let me start with you. You've been writing about the challenges within the organization as well as the frustrations of membering states. So what does the pointed exchange of last week tells you about where we are headed from here?
Thank you very much, Mohammed, for this very difficult question, because this is a very difficult and no task to, you know, to speculate about the future. But please allow me, before I will tell what I think, just to make a very quick follow-up with what Bruce said, namely the two things. First, about the observer status. You know, for me, I don't see observer status in the Eurasian Economic Union as the half open the door, half close the door, you know. I think the observer status is nothing. Observer status creates no commitment. You can have as much observers as you want, and this is the core members and the observers. This is a principal difference between those. And the second thing is about, and here I agree very much, and this is what I should say, in the Russian media discourse, issues with the Belarus and Armenia are much more pronounced than these of the Central Asia. This is something telling in it for me, at least.
Why?
Because if we take again the Eurasian Economic Union from this is what you want to sell or to present somehow to the Russian internal audience, then you speak about being rational. You talk about much more about Belarus than about Central Asia. Yeah. Central Asia is not basically a positive card with which you can create enthusiasm within the Russian population because of the labor migrants, first of all, who are stuck in Moscow, who are sitting in Moscow and in the other big cities, and so on and so forth. So if you want to talk what is kind of more popular within the society, you would talk about Belarus, and you would probably talk about Armenia. This is my impression. Maybe I'm mistaken. And where we go,
Irina, maybe let's come to that a little bit later. What we were talking about earlier, that, you know, there were problems between the countries, within the organization structure. Things were discussed a little bit mildly, maybe behind the doors, but now we are just in public. I mean, the way President Tokayev was talking about this, now it's in public. And the criticism are very sharp compared to the past. So what I'm saying is, what has changed that this is happening?
You know, I think this is my guess would be, and here I am on the solid ground, probably this is because of the more, probably because of the more uncertainty, you know, and this is because uncertainty increased immensely with the pandemic and with the COVID-19. So you kind of, you are in isolation, you know, you are necessarily closing your country. So you are more by yourself, I would say. And being more by yourself, you probably feel more free. And what was more or less undercover and what was more regulated and more probably more controlled by Russia is now, again, this is my guess, this now, because nobody knows what would happen after the crisis and when the crisis would be overcome and how deep will be the economic crisis or recession and so on and so forth. So this is probably, and the second thing again, and this is also related to the COVID, is that the COVID was also the test for the robustness of this organization, of the union. And this was nothing done, you know, as you know, probably. I'm sure you know, it did not in any moment of this since the beginning of the crisis have the Eurasian Economic Union acted in a coordinated way or were looking for coordinated ways. So this is for coordinated solutions. Right. You know, for me, this was for those who deals with these types of the regional organization groups. This is a test. This is an experiment which came with the crisis.
And you said that...
How much do they cost?
Interesting. Okay, Ben, I guess I would like to hear your points on what changed from Kazakhstan's perspective, like especially Tokayev started talking about this in a very critical terms, type of things that you said Nazarbayev wouldn't have done, but he's doing it. What has changed?
Well, I think we also have to differentiate between what was designed for an external audience and what was designed for an internal audience. As soon as Tokayev had made those statements, his sort of paid supporters on social media instantly promoted it. It was clear that Tokayev wanted this to be seen by the local population. But if you examine the various media coverage from Russia, from Belarus, and from Kazakhstan, basically you'll see that every leader went into that meeting with what they wanted to say, and then the local media reported what they said, not taking into account anything that was said by any of the other leaders, really. So Russians came away saying, yes, the strategy was a success. It was more or less adopted with one or two things to fix. You know, the Kazakh media reported that, no, the strategy was not adopted because Tokayev stood up and said, nope, this isn't going to happen. You know, we have to rethink this whole thing. And if you look at the Belarusian media, it said, you know, Lukashenko had a great victory securing more talks on gas negotiations over the single gas market. So I think a lot of it comes down to how it plays on the local sort of internal, among local and internal populations. And I think the other thing is that probably a lot of the measures in this strategy wouldn't have been adopted anyway. So why not look like the person that stood up and stopped it being adopted if it was not going to be adopted in any case? So I think there's a lot of political point scoring from Tokayev's point of view. But of course, there is growing frustration that, you know, trade has actually fallen within the Eurasian Economic Union compared to before the Eurasian Economic Union came into effect. And if things don't change radically now, then the purpose of the Eurasian Economic Union is lost. So I think you see all of the constituent nations getting together and saying, let's just focus on the core things that we agreed in 2015 to remove tariff barriers, to remove non-tariff barriers, and to increase internal trade within our markets. Let's focus on that, get that done before we think about any other levels of integration.
Right. Oscar, you know, about Kyrgyzstan, it's not the first time, as you said, Kyrgyzstan is complaining about certain things about this organization. But what can they really do about this?
I'd just like to mention that apart from those issues with the movement of goods and services, our president has also raised the issue of macroeconomic support to the member countries on behalf of Eurasian Development Bank and Eurasian Stabilization Fund, and also EU's digitalization agenda, because as to our country, we haven't seen that many developments in this regard, and it's especially important given this corona crisis impact we had.
Yeah, but what Kyrgyzstan can really do to achieve these priorities, it doesn't sound like there is a match between Kyrgyzstan's expectation and the agenda on the table. As Irina was saying, for Russia, especially when it comes to his Central Asian partners, the objective of this organization has never been an economy. And you are talking about more money, more financial incentives. So what can Kyrgyzstan really do to make those priorities?
What we can do? Well, those issues that our side has suggested, as my colleagues mentioned, creating a mechanism of dispute settlement kind of Eurasian Economic Union's court, and secondly also creating some kind of remedies for enforcing the free movement of goods and services, something like sanctions that could be imposed by Eurasian Economic Commission on those countries that do not abide by the union's procedures. This could possibly work as well if all member countries agree, because any union should also have the workable remedies, right, instruments to enforce those rules and regulations that are adopted. Because apart from, you know, voicing those issues, apart from including them into the agenda of the supreme bodies of the union, there should be a permanent body like Eurasian Economic Commission with enough competence and enough powers to enforce those rules and regulations.
Thank you, Oskar. And Bruce, earlier we were talking about this a little bit. These challenges are immense when you look into this from a different perspective. What Kazakhstan wants doesn't suit Kyrgyzstan's priorities. On the top of that, Russia is sitting with its own priorities, where economy might not be even the first objective of this apparently an economic organization. On the top of that, now COVID-19, it's possible economic fallout to the region. When you look into this from a broader picture, the first question comes to your mind is, are these challenges the early signs of crack in this organization? How do you interpret these challenges with regards to the future of this organization, especially when it comes to Central Asia?
Well, I mean, there was always cracks in the organization, and let's not forget that this organization in one form or another has existed for practically 25 years. It keeps getting renamed. I mean, Putin brought a new energy back into it. It was moribund not so long ago, but there had always been some cracks, and of course everyone looks at this from their own point of view, what they get out of this. Oscar would remember well that when Kyrgyzstan was about to get into the Eurasian Economic Union, there was people in Kyrgyzstan that didn't see any advantage in this at all, and thought that they didn't have any choice. They were being forced into it. There was no way to get around it. It was Putin. Putin wanted as many countries in the CIS, former Soviet republics, to be in this as possible, and they didn't have a whole lot of choice in getting in. The then Prime Minister, Jolomart Otarbayev, said as much at one point. So, there was always going to be some problems. I think it's a good point about the COVID, the coronavirus problems that are thrown into this, is that, the whole point of this thing last week was supposed to be talking about further integration. Well, at a time when the global economy is kind of in shambles at the moment, and no one's really sure what's going to happen when you come out of this, you don't want to be tied to one particular group, because you're not sure who you're going to need when this all comes out. When it all starts to shake out and things start to recover a little bit, it will not be unknown to the other members of the Eurasian Economic Union that Russia is going to have a lot of problems because of, their dependency on oil exports, oil and gas exports, which are going down. Russia cannot support them, help them out financially and economically as much as is unlikely to be able to anyway in the coming year or two, and maybe longer, as they have been to some extent for the last 4 or 5 years. So to commit to the organization firmly would not be a prudent move at this moment. You want to keep all your options open, because like I said, you're not sure how this is going to wind up when things start to get moved toward normal again. I think that was what we saw last week, was a lot of frustration about, yes, Russia is our partner. Yes, we want them. Russia has been our partner. We want Russia to be our partner. But, we're not sure what our needs are going to be if even 3 or 4 months from now, let alone 3 or 4 years from now. And we don't want to tie our horse to this wagon right yet. 100%, and certainly if we're not getting everything that we want, or most of what we want, out of this deal. So I think that's part of the big problem at the moment.
I also don't understand, like, one thing. Some countries like Kyrgyzstan, for example, has been complaining about various things involving this organization, and still it is within the organization. Oskar, why you don't quit this?
Well, for obvious reasons. There are a number of obvious reasons. First, we've got several hundred thousand labor migrants, our compatriots working in Russia and sending money to their families and homes. This money, just to give you a picture, is almost equal to a third of our national GDP.
But also think about this. I mean, Tajikistan has even more than Kyrgyzstan does migrant workers in Russia. And Uzbekistan is in a similar position, but they are not yet members, and they can survive. Why not Kyrgyzstan? I'm just trying to understand why keep complaining and not quitting it.
Good question. Another reason is we received one of the most valuable fuel sources from Russia and Kazakhstan. Mostly our fossil fuels come from Russia and from Russia refineries. And the same goes for natural gas. The state-owned natural gas company, Kyrgyz Gas, has been sold to Gazprom several years ago. Perhaps you are also aware. And now Gazprom controls the gas pipelines around the country. This is another reason. And also one more important reason is that trade accounts for a large bulk of our nation's income. And the trade involves re-exporting Chinese and other goods through Kyrgyzstan to Kazakhstan and Russia. And this re-export gives a good income for our people. This might be another reason to hold with this union. And when we entered the union, perhaps you also might be aware that there's been a Russian-Kyrgyz Development Fund created in Kyrgyzstan that is now successfully operating and providing cheap loans for farmers and beyond.
Okay, so I think we also need to be going towards the conclusion of the discussion. So maybe let me get back to the same point that I raised earlier, Irina. So what's next in this conversation? Where our eyes should be to determine where things are headed going forward?
Thank you very much, Mohammed, where things are headed. But before I would say, could I please very briefly comment on why complaining is not and not quitting? Because for me, this is because you can convert complaints into bargaining chips because you still have concessions and use the institutions and so on and so forth. But if you quit, you quit. So it's much more rational, much more wise to complain and not quit than quit, because quit you can only once and then you don't have anything.
Is there anyone? Is there anyone fixing those problems? Kyrgyzstan has been complaining for a long time now, but is there anyone paying attention and fixing those problems?
You don't complain necessarily for fix the problems. You know, there are a lot of you can complain about one I would say dimension and have your concessions in the other dimension. You know, you can make the spillover. So it is. I think this is more than one play here. Mm. But this is kind of complicated, and some of the plays are hidden from our eyes. We don't know about them. Probably. Mm. And where the things are headed, you know, I would say that I slightly disagree with not disagree, but I'm not as optimistic as Oscar, who said about the making the Eurasian Court into a real mechanism of the tension and conflict resolution, similar to the European Court of Justice. I don't think this would ever happen, because this would mean the real integration and the real supranationality, since this is the court which really makes the European Union one of the pillars of this community method. So and here we come to answer the question where we go. This is about the purpose, and this is what you mentioned, this notion of purpose. I think there is not one purpose, and this is a problem. There are many purposes. There are many interests under the Eurasian Economic Union, many groups, and this is many purposes. Also inside one country, inside each member state, there are the whole variety of vectors who are supporting different agendas. Mm. For me, I don't see any future as an integration bloc under any conditions, COVID, non-COVID, pandemic, non-pandemic. You know, these are limitations. And the Eurasian Economic Union, please let us not forget that this body has been created in a very special condition during the Ukrainian crisis. It was a game changer, and it brought into being the Eurasian Economic Union. You know, and this is a very different story to maintain it. And you know what I see in the Russian perspective, I see the necessity to see how high the Eurasian Economic Union stands in the Russian agenda, and this is not very high, because yes, and if Russia would feel like there are no kind, this product cannot be sold, in particular again, and I insist on this to the internal audience, so it will go even lower into the agenda. Mm-hmm. And you know, and this is what happened many times, a lot of enthusiasm when it you can instrumentalize it. If not, it goes very much to the back.
And also, Irina, now you are saying that, you know, it's not high on the Russian agenda, but what will happen to this when Vladimir Putin no more president?
You expect such an unusual situation, and he's not the president. You know, I don't know. You know, I cannot. You know, it will always be a factor. You know, it will at least what I can say at the moment. You know, this is Vladimir Putin or not Vladimir Putin. You know, this is the post-Soviet, or better saying now Eurasian factor, Eurasian geography in the Russian foreign policy will always have some importance. The problem of what kind of importance, you know, how will it move across this line of the prioritiedness in the Russian agenda? What we can state now, that it can be very high and very low. You know, you can play with it. You can consolidate the discourse. You can deconsolidate. You can almost forget about this. So yeah. This is possible for a country like Russia. You know, since Russia has it has a very multi-dimensional foreign policy.
Very interesting. Okay, so we really need to conclude the discussion here. Is there anyone who wanted to say something? I just heard a voice.
This is Ben here.
Yeah, Ben, quickly. Yeah.
Yes, I think in conclusion, I think I'd say I agree with Irina and Askar. You're not likely to see greater integration because things like a supranational court of justice would be handing over too much sovereignty. The idea that a supranational body could enforce court decisions over different countries, particularly over Russia, in fact, if it rules against Russia, is very unlikely. But at the same time, is it really likely that countries are going to jump out of the Eurasian Economic Union at this point? At the moment, they are seeing some basic benefits, certainly not the benefits that they'd like to see. But I think if you think about the disbenefits of leaving, both economic and potentially political, you're likely to not see countries leaving. So at the end of the day, I see the Eurasian Economic Union bumbling along like it has done for the last sort of 6 or 7 years. You know, you're going to have low-level disputes constantly and proclamations made every year or so, but not fully implemented.
Bruce, let's get final thoughts from you. So where your eyes will be as a journalist to determine where things are headed from here?
Well, you know, I'll just kind of what I said before is once this crisis starts to ease, I'll be looking to see what the individual countries feel that they need at this point. And are there other members of the Eurasian Economic Union that can fill those needs, or can Russia fill those needs, you know, or are they going to have to look further away for what they think they absolutely have to have here in the near future? You know, like I said, this organization in one form or another has been kind of making its way along for a quarter of a century. It has its highs and lows, you know, and if for some reason one of the countries or two of the countries, I don't think they'll leave, but I do think that they might want to reset some of the their own individual priorities. And like Tokayev said, I mean, it was one of the points that he said, we don't want the Eurasian Economic Union to be able to look at our agreements with third countries. That's not none of their business. You know, and I think you'll probably get a lot more of that as we come out of this, the coronavirus crisis, where people say, look, we have to take care of our own people. And if we can't do it within the EU, then we'll do it with somebody else, understanding that we're not interested in leaving, but we do have to take care of what we need to take care of.
Okay. Terrific. Thank you very much, Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owozi. And also big thanks goes to Askar Sadikov, the executive director of the International Business Council of Kyrgyzstan, Ben Goodwin, head of analysis at the PRISM Political Risk Management, Dr. Irina Busigina, professor at the Higher School of Economics and Science, Petersburg University. Thank you, colleagues, for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. This is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager and host of the Majlis. A podcast. Until next week, bye-bye.